cha to begin that ayatana section. This is chapter 5, sense contact. It's from the food for the heart. Sense contact, the fount of wisdom. All of us have made up our minds to become bhikkhus and samaneras, or novices, in the Buddhist dispensation in order to find peace. Now, what is true peace? True peace, the Buddha said, is not very far away. It lies right here within us. But we tend to continually overlook it. People long to find peace, but still experience confusion and agitation. They remain unsure of themselves and haven't yet found fulfillment in their practice. It's as if we have left home and are traveling to here and there, but as long as we still haven't reached home, we don't feel content. We still have some unfinished business to take care of. This is because our journey is unfinished. We haven't yet reached our destination. All bhikkhus and samaneras want peace, every one of us. When I was young, I searched all over for it. Wherever I went, I wasn't satisfied. Wandering into forests, visiting various teachers, listening to Dhamma talks, nowhere did I find satisfaction. Why is this? We search for peace in places where there are few sights, sounds, odors, or tastes, believing that living quietly will lead to contentment. But actually, if we live very quietly in places where nothing arises, can wisdom arise? Would we be aware of anything? Think about it. What would it be like if the eye didn't see sights, if the nose didn't experience smells, if the tongue didn't experience flavors? If the body didn't experience feelings? To be like that would be like being a blind, a deaf person, one whose nose and tongue had fallen off and who was completely numb with paralysis. Would there be anything there? And yet people tend to think that if they went somewhere where nothing happened, they would find peace. When I was a young monk just starting to practice, I'd sit in meditation and sounds would disturb me. I'd think to myself, what can I do to make my mind peaceful? So I took some beeswax and stuffed my ears with it so that I couldn't hear anything. All that remained was a humming sound. I thought that would be peaceful. But no, all that thinking and confusion didn't arise at the ears after all. It arose at the mind. That is the place to search for peace. To put it another way, no matter where you stay, you don't want to do anything because it interferes with your practice. You don't want to sweep the grounds or do anything like that. You just want to sit still and find peace that way. The teacher asks you to help out with the chores or any of the daily duties, but you don't put your heart into it because you feel it is only an external concern. One of my disciples was really eager to let go and find peace. I had taught about, quote-unquote, letting go, and he thought that by letting go of everything, he would become peaceful. Right from the day he came here, he didn't want to do anything. Even when the wind blew half the roof off his kuti, he wasn't interested in doing anything about it. He said that that was just an external thing, so he didn't bother fixing it up. When the sunlight or rain came in from one side, he'd move over to the other side. His sole business was to make his mind peaceful. The other stuff was a distraction. One day I was walking past and saw the collapsed roof. Hey, whose kuti is this? I wondered. Someone told me whose it was, and I thought, strange. So I had a talk with him, explaining many things, such as senasanavatta, the duties of monks with regard to their dwellings. We must have a dwelling place, and we must look after it. Letting go isn't like this. It doesn't mean shirking our responsibilities. That's the action of a fool. The rain comes in on one side, so you move over to the other side. Then the sun shines in, so you move back to that side. Why is that? Why don't you bother to let go there? I gave him a long discourse on this. When I'd finished, he said, Oh, Lumpa, sometimes you teach me to cling and sometimes you teach me to let go. I don't know what you want me to do. Even when my roof collapses and I let go to this extent, still you say it's not right. And yet you teach me to let go. I don't know what more you can expect of me. That's the way some people are. They can be that stupid. The sense bases of eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, and mind are all things that can facilitate the arising of wisdom, if we know them as they are. If we don't really know them, we must deny them, saying we don't want to see sights, hear sounds, and so on, because they disturb us. If we cut off the causal conditions, what are we going to contemplate? This is why we are taught to be restrained. Restraint is sila. There is the sila of sense restraint, eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind. These are our sila, and they are our samadhi. Reflect on the story of Sariputta. Once, before he became a bhikkhu, he saw Asajitera going an alms round. Seeing him, Sariputta thought, "This monk is most unusual. He walks neither too fast nor too slow. His robes are neatly worn. His bearing is restrained." Sariputta found the monk inspiring, so he approached Venerable Asaji, paid his respects, and asked, "Excuse me, sir, who are you?" "I am a samana." "Who is your teacher?"
"Venerable Gotama is my teacher."
"What does Venerable Gotama teach?"
"He teaches that all things arise because of conditions. When they cease, it's because the causal conditions have ceased."
When Sariputta asked about the Dhamma, Asaji gave this brief explanation of cause and effect. Dhammas arise because of causes. The cause arises first and then the result. If the result is to cease, the cause must first cease. That's all he said. But it was enough for Sariputta.
And of course that was Sariputta's entry into the Dhamma, into street experience of stream entry.
Now this was a cause for the arising of Dhamma. At that time, Sariputta had eyes, he had ears, a nose, a tongue, a body, and a mind. All his faculties were intact. If he didn't have his faculties, would there have been sufficient causes for wisdom to arise for him? Would he have been aware of anything? But most of us are afraid of contact. Either that, or we like to have contact. But we develop no wisdom from it. Instead, we repeatedly indulge ourselves through eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, and mind, delighting in sense objects and getting lost in them. These sense bases can entice us into delight and indulgence, or they can lead to knowledge and wisdom. So we should take everything as practice, even the bad things. When we talk of practice, we don't simply mean taking those things that are good and pleasing to us. That's not how it is. In this world, some things are to our liking, some are not. Usually whatever we like, we want, even with fellow monks and novices. Whatever monk or novice we don't like, we don't want to associate with. We only want to be with those we like. You see, this is choosing according to our likes. Usually whatever we don't like, we don't want to see or know about. But the Buddha wanted us to experience these things. Loka vidu, because that's an epithet of the Buddha. Look at this world and know it clearly. If we don't know the truth of the world clearly, then we can't go anywhere. Living in the world, we must understand the world. The noble ones of the past, including the Buddha, all lived with these things. They lived in this world, among deluded people, and attained the truth right here, nowhere else. But they had wisdom. They restrained their senses. Restraint doesn't mean we don't see anything, hear anything, smell, taste, feel, or think anything. If practitioners don't understand this, then as soon as they see or hear something, they will cower and run away, thinking that by so doing, that thing will eventually lose its power over them, that they will eventually transcend it. But they won't. They won't transcend anything that way. If they run away, not knowing the truth about it, later on, the same stuff will pop up and have to be dealt with again. Consider, for example, those practitioners who are never content, be they in monasteries, forests, or mountains.
They wander on a Tudonga pilgrimage, looking at this, that, and the other thing, thinking they'll find contentment that way. They try going to a mountaintop. Ah, this is the spot. Now I'm okay. They feel at peace for a few days, and then get tired of it. Oh well, off to the seaside. Ah, here it's nice and cool. This'll do me fine. After a while, they get tired of the seaside as well. Tired of the forest, tired of the mountains, tired of the seaside, tired of everything. This is not being tired of things in the right sense, as right view. It's simply boredom, a kind of wrong view. When they get back to the monastery, now what will I do? I've been all over and I've come back with nothing. So they throw away their bowls and disrobe. Why do they disrobe? Because they haven't got any grip on the practice. They don't see anything left to do. They go to the south, to the north, to the seaside, to the mountains, into the forests, and still don't see anything. So it's all finished. They die. This is how it goes. It's because they're continually running away from things. Wisdom doesn't arise. Now take another example. Suppose there is a monk who resolves to stay with things, not to run away. He looks after himself. He knows himself and others. He's continually dealing with problems. Suppose he's the abbot. An abbot faces a constant stream of things demanding attention. People are always asking questions. So you must be constantly on the alert, constantly awake. Before you can doze off, they wake you up again with another problem. This leads you to contemplate and understand things. You become skillful in regard to yourself and others in many, many ways. This skill arises from contact, from confronting and dealing with things, from not running away. We don't run away physically, but we run away in mind, using our wisdom. We understand with wisdom right here. We don't run away from anything. This is a source of wisdom. One must work, must associate with other things. For instance, living in a big monastery, we must all help look after things. Looking at it in one way, you could say that it's all defilement. Living with lots of monks, nuns, and novices, with many lay people coming and going, many defilements may arise. But we must live like this for the development of wisdom and the abandonment of foolishness. Which way are we to go? Are we going to live in order to get rid of our foolishness or to increase it? We must contemplate. Whenever eyes, ears, nose, tongue, body, or mind make contact, we should be collected and circumspect. When suffering arises, who is suffering? Why did this suffering arise? The abbot of a monastery has to supervise many disciples. This may cause suffering. If we are afraid of suffering and don't want to face it, where are we going to do battle with it? If suffering arises and we don't know it, how are we going to deal with it? Escaping from suffering means knowing the way out of suffering. It doesn't mean running away from wherever suffering arises. By doing that, you just carry your suffering with you. If you want to understand suffering, you must look into the situation at hand. The teachings say that wherever a problem arises, it must be settled right there. Where suffering lies is right where non-suffering will arise. It ceases at the place where it arises. You should settle the issue right there. One who runs away from suffering out of fear is the most foolish person of all. They will simply increase their stupidity endlessly. Suffering is none other than the first noble truth. Isn't that so? Are you going to look on it as something bad? Dukkha satcha, samudaya satcha, nirodha satcha, mangha satcha. The truth of suffering, the truth of its cause, the truth of its cessation, and the truth of the way leading to the cessation of suffering. Running away from these things isn't practicing according to the true Dhamma. The Buddha taught us to, quote-unquote, run away using wisdom. For instance, suppose you step on a thorn or splinter and it gets embedded in your foot. As you walk, sometimes it hurts, sometimes not. Sometimes when you step on a stone or a stump, it really hurts. So you feel around your foot, but not finding anything, you shrug it off and keep on walking. Eventually, you step on something else and you feel the pain again. This happens repeatedly. What is the cause of that pain? The cause is that splinter or thorn embedded in your foot. The pain is constantly near. Whenever the pain arises, you take a look and feel around a bit, but not seeing the splinter, you let it go. After a while, it hurts again, so you take another look. When suffering arises, you must note it. Don't just shrug it off. Whenever the pain arises, you note, that splinter is still there. Whenever the pain arises, there arises also the thought that that splinter has got to go. If you don't take it out, there will only be more pain later on. The pain recurs again and again until the desire to take out that thorn is constantly with you. In the end, it reaches a point where you make up your mind once and for all to get that splinter out because it hurts. Now, our effort in the practice must be like this. Wherever it hurts, wherever there's friction, we must investigate. Confront the problem head on. Take that thorn out of your foot. Just pull it out. Wherever your mind gets stuck, you must take note. As you look into it, you will know it, see it, and experience it as it is. But our practice must be unwavering and persistent. They call it viriyarampa, putting forth constant effort. Whenever an unpleasant feeling arises in your foot, for example, you must remind yourself to get that thorn out. You don't give up your resolve. Likewise, when suffering arises in our hearts, we must have the unwavering resolve to try to uproot the defilements, to give them up. This resolve is constantly there, unremitting. Eventually, the defilements will fall into our hands, where we can finish them off. So, in regards to happiness and suffering, what are we to do? All dhammas arise because of causes. When the result ceases, it's because the cause has ceased. Whatever we don't hold fast to, cling to, or fix onto, is as if it weren't there. Suffering doesn't arise. Suffering arises from existence, from bhava or becoming. If there is existence, then there is birth. Upadana, clinging or attachment, is the prerequisite that creates suffering. Wherever suffering arises, look into it. Look right into the present moment. Look at your own mind and body. When suffering arises, ask, why is there suffering? Look right now. When happiness arises, what is the cause of that happiness? Look right there. Wherever these things arise, be aware. Both happiness and suffering arise from clinging. The practitioners of old saw their minds in this way. There is only arising and ceasing. There is no abiding entity. They contemplated from all angles and saw that there was nothing much to this mind. Nothing is stable. There is only arising and ceasing. Ceasing and arising. Nothing is of any lasting substance. While walking or sitting, they saw things in this way. Wherever they looked, there was only suffering. That's all. It's just like a big iron ball which has just been forged in a furnace. It's hot all over. If you touch the top, it's hot. Touch the sides and they're hot. It's hot all over. There isn't any place on which it is cool. If we don't consider these things, we know nothing about them. We must see clearly. Don't get, quote unquote, born into things. Don't fall into birth. Know the workings of birth. Such thoughts as, oh, I can't stand that person. He does everything wrongly, will no longer arise. Or, I really like so-and-so. These things don't arise. There remain merely the conventional worldly standards of like and dislike. We must use the conventions of the world to communicate with each other, but inwardly we must be empty. This is the abiding of the noble ones. We must all aim for this and practice accordingly. Don't get caught up in doubts. Before I started to practice, I thought to myself, the Buddhist religion is here, available for all, and yet why do only some people practice while others don't? Or if they do practice, they do so only for a short while, then give it up. Or again, those who don't give it up still don't knuckle down and do the practice. Why is this? So I resolve. Okay? I'll give up this body and mind for this lifetime and try to follow the teaching of the Buddha down to the last detail. I'll reach understanding in this very lifetime, because if I don't, I'll still be sunk in suffering. I'll let go of everything else and make a determined effort. No matter how much difficulty or suffering I have to endure, I'll persevere. If I don't do this, I'll just keep on doubting. Thinking like this, I got down to practice. No matter how much happiness, suffering, or difficulty I'd have to endure, I would do it. I would do it. I looked on my whole life as if it were only one day and a night. I gave it up. I'll follow the teaching of the Buddha. I'll follow the Dhamma to understanding. Why is this world of delusion so wretched? I wanted to know. I wanted to master the teachings. So I turned to the practice of Dhamma. How much of the worldly life do we monastics renounce? If we have gone forth for good, it means we renounce it all. We cast off everything that people enjoy, sight, sound, smells, tastes, and feelings. We throw them all away, and yet we experience them. So Dhamma practitioners must be content with little and remain detached. Whether in regard to speech, in eating, or whatever, we must be easily satisfied. Eat simply, sleep simply, live simply. The more you practice like this, the more satisfaction you will find. You will see into your own heart. The Dhamma is Paccatan. You know it for yourself. To know for yourself means to practice for yourself. You can depend on a teacher only 50% of the way. Even the teaching I have given you today is completely useless in itself. It is worth hearing, but if you were to believe it just because I said so, you wouldn't be using it properly. If you believe me completely, you'd be foolish. Put the teaching into practice for yourself. See it within yourself. Do it yourself. This is much more useful. You will then know the taste of Dhamma. This is why the Buddha didn't talk about the fruits of the practice in much detail, because it's something one can't convey in words. It would be like trying to describe different colors to a person blind from birth. It's bright yellow. That wouldn't serve much purpose. The Buddha brings it back down to the individual. You have to see clearly for yourself. If you see clearly for yourself, you'll have clear proof within yourself. Whether standing, walking, sitting, or reclining, you'll be free of doubt. Even if someone were to say, "Your practice is all wrong," you'd be unmoved, because you have your own proof. As a practitioner of the Dhamma, that's the way you must be, wherever you are. Others can't tell you. You must know for yourself. Sammāditti, right view, must be there. But to really practice like this for even 1 month in 5 or 10 rains retreats would be rare. Once I went to live up north with some monks who were elderly but newly ordained, with only 2 or 3 rains retreats. At the time, I had 10 rains. Living with those old monks, I decided to perform the various duties that junior monks usually do, receiving their bowls, washing their robes, emptying their spittoons, and so on. I didn't think in terms of doing it for any particular individual. I was simply maintaining my practice. Since others weren't performing these duties, I do them myself. I saw it as a good opportunity to gain merit, and it gave me a sense of satisfaction. On the Uposatha days, I'd go and clean out the Uposatha hall and set out water for washing and drinking. The others didn't know anything about these duties. They just watched. I didn't criticize them because they didn't know. I did the duties myself, and having done them, I felt pleased with myself. I had inspiration and a lot of energy in my practice. Whenever I could do something in the monastery, whether in my own kutti or others, if it was dirty, I'd clean up. I didn't do it to impress anyone, but simply to maintain a good practice. Cleaning a kutti or dwelling place is just like cleaning rubbish out of your own mind. This is something you should bear in mind. Live together with Dhamma, with peace and restraint, with a trained mind, and you won't have to worry about harmony. It will arise automatically, and there'll be no problems. If there's heavy work to be done, everybody helps out. and in no time at all, it gets done. That's the best way. I have come across some other types of monks, though, and these encounters have been opportunities to grow. For instance, in a big monastery, the monks and novices may agree among themselves to wash robes on a certain day. I'd go and boil up the jackfruit wood. Now there'd be some monks who'd wait for someone else to boil up the jackfruit wood, and then come along and wash the robes, take them back to the kutis, hang them up, and then take a nap. They didn't have to set up the fire, didn't have to clean up afterward. They thought they were on to a good thing, that they were being clever. This is the height of stupidity. These people are just increasing their own foolishness because they don't do anything. They leave all the work up to others. Therefore, whether speaking, eating, or doing anything whatsoever, reflect on yourself. You may want to live comfortably, eat comfortably, sleep comfortably, but you can't. What have we come here for? If we regularly reflect on this, we will be heedful. We won't forget. We will be constantly alert. Being alert like this, we will put forth effort in all postures. If we don't put forth effort, things go quite differently. Sitting, you sit as though you're in the town. Walking, you walk as though you're in the town. And then you want to go and fool around in the town with the lay people. If there is no effort in the practice, the mind will tend in that direction. You don't oppose and resist your own mind. You just allow it to waft along on the wind of your moods. This is called following one's moods, like a child. If we indulge all at once, will it be a good child? If the parents indulge all the child's wishes, is that good? Even if they do indulge it somewhat at first, by the time it can speak, they may start to occasionally spank it because they're afraid it'll end up stupid. The training of our mind must be like this. You have to know yourself and how to train yourself. If you don't know how to train your own mind, waiting around expecting someone else to train it for you, you'll end up in trouble. Practice has no limits. Whether standing, walking, sitting, or lying down, you can always practice. You can realize the Dhamma while sweeping the monastery grounds or seeing a beam of sunlight. But you must have sati at hand. If you meditate ardently, you can realize the Dhamma at any time, in any place. Don't be heedless. Be watchful. Be alert. While walking an alms round, there are all sorts of feelings arising, and it's all good Dhamma. When you get back to the monastery and are eating your food, there's plenty of good Dhamma for you to look into. If you have constant effort, all these things will be objects for contemplation. Wisdom will arise, and you will see the Dhamma. This is called Dhamma Vichaya, reflecting on Dhamma. It's one of the factors of enlightenment. If we have mindfulness, we won't simply take it easy, and there will always be inquiry into Dhamma. If we have reached this stage, our practice will know neither day nor night. It will continue on regardless of the time of day. Nothing will taint the practice, or if something does, we will immediately know it. When our practice enters the flow, there will be Dhamma Vichaya within our minds, constant investigation of the Dhamma. The mind won't go chasing after things. I think I'll take a trip over there, perhaps to this other place, but over there should be interesting. That's the way of the world. Go that way, and the practice will soon die. Be constantly alert. Study constantly. Seeing a tree or an animal can be an occasion for study. Bring it all inward. See clearly within your own heart. When some sensation makes an impact on the heart, witness it clearly for yourself. Have you ever seen a kiln for brickmaking? A fire is built about 2 or 3 feet in front of it. If we make a brick kiln in the right way, all the heat goes into the kiln and the job gets done quickly. This is the way we Dhamma practitioners should experience things. All our feelings will be drawn inward to be turned into right view. Seeing sights, hearing sounds, smelling odors, tasting flavors, the mind draws them all inward. Those feelings can then give it rise to wisdom. Questions?
Sense contact, the fount of wisdom. So I'm not sure what it, some of the, in the new collection, I'm not sure if Ajahn Mun Nindo has changed the, I know he has changed some of the titles, but whether that one's changed or not, I don't know.
Usually this
change
title,
yeah. Yeah.
I might be jumping ahead, I'm not really worried about such a, in this talk, Lumpur was mentioning the mind drawing the senses together, and I'm looking for one place, and I know Lumpur did the simile of like the spider in the center of the spider net, or the watching the kind of plugging up the various holes in the termite mound and watching it in one hole,
yeah.
Where the lizard went.
Yeah.
And could you say a few words about, just kind of taking the position of like, kind of being, watching the mind, being at the mind, because that's where essentially the sense objects kind of all meet.
Right.
As opposed to sort of separating them out.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I think that's a, certainly in terms of the, when we're meditating, or sitting meditating, or doing walking meditation, when things are a bit more contained, then it's really helpful to come in and see the effect that on the mind, the reaction within the mind that happens because of the sense contact, so that that observation is so pulled together into one place. But I think in terms of in our engagement, then sometimes it's helpful to be attentive to the sense doors, just because things are sometimes happening a bit more quickly, and it's helpful to recognize that sense contact. Sometimes we can be composed enough to be with the mind itself, but sometimes we're just not quick enough. So that a lot of it is a practical practicality of what's actually going to work and help. So the but certainly in terms of the when things are somewhat quiet enough, if we're sitting meditation, walking meditation, then we can draw that attention in to the watching the arising and passing away of our recognition of the sense contact and the movement of the mind, independence on that contact in those different ways.